know, we've got a situation here that's quite unique. We got something that's going on in the Bay Area that you want to know about. And it's just an embarrassment of riches. And that's Brother John Henneberry from Occupy Oakland. He's going to tell us about his fight against the system. See, there's many ways to fight. People think you fight with a bottle. You break a window. That's nonsense. You don't stop Babylon with no bottle. At the same time, we have a historic figure here. And the whole question of reconciliation comes in on a much higher intellectual, social, and political level. And so you're going to get a history lesson today, living history. Right now, though, I do want to give a couple of reports. We've got this Standing Rock going on still. Mr. Obama has stated that he is going to let things play out. Now, what does that mean when they've sick dogs? Sick dogs on these Indians. America, we're not in very good shape here. People have a right to demonstrate, a right to carry out the First Amendment. That's what the various Indian tribes at Standing Rock have been doing. And the treatment that they have received, the beatings, the provocation, they showed, in fact, a Caucasian with an AR-15 trying to work his way into the demonstration. What's that about? I'll talk about it in 1 minute. I'll be right back. What I was referring to, I mean, many of you may be aware of this Standing Rock situation. According to Mr. Hightower's lowdown, we're talking about a battle against what? What are we fighting here? The Indians are talking about their sacred lands. They're talking about the water protectors. Well, regardless of one's opinion about the cultural essence of what the Indians are putting forward, the fact of the matter is, and this is what blew my mind, this is not the only pipeline in the United States. And here's what I just read in Mr. Hightower's lowdown, is that all this pipeline is going to be 30 inches in diameter, right? And it's going to stretch for thousands of miles. It's going to go from North Dakota to South Dakota through those states and wind up in, I think, Illinois. Now, look, did you know that just this year, how many accidents have occurred with pipelines in America? We reported last week it was over 200 pipeline leaks in America this year. Now, that ranges from a small leak where you get maybe 55 gallons of oil all the way to explosions where there was fire after the leak. So this is not a minor thing. They got $3.8 billion. I can't even count that high. I can't tell you how many zeros. Wait, millions is what, six? So billions is nine, I guess. Nine zeros behind all of this madness. So clearly, the 1%, the ruling class, wants to go forward with this investment. No doubt. In their way, these Indian brothers and sisters who have showed courage unmatched. Unmatched. Now, I'm mentioning the man with this AR-15 that was trying to infiltrate their little demonstration there, because I saw this on Democracy Now, a program that you might want to check out from time to time. And it showed this guy's got an AR-15 in his hands, and these Indians is walking up on him. They weren't running and ducking for cover. They running directly at this fool. And I just looked and I said, oh, man, come on now. What y'all do? Courage, determination, unmatched. And really, who are they really fighting for? I'm going to tell you who they're fighting for. People don't want to really think about it, but they're fighting for you. Don't get stuck on the question of the ancient lands, okay? Think about the water. We all have to drink clean water and breathe clean air. And when you do, I want you to thank the Indians for what they're doing. Now, here's part of the problem we have today. I went to a labor support rally for Standing Rock. It took place in front of Wells Fargo, 13th Street and Broadway. And this is what I learned. Now, I am a retired member of the International Brotherhood of Electrical Workers, the IBEW. 34 years. Here's what I learned. That union leaders have called upon the governor of the state of North Dakota to increase his repression against these Indians. I'll just read the first paragraph of their letter and tell you who they are. This letter reads, "Dear Governor," this is the governor of North Dakota, and it says, "The Dakota Access Pipeline was lawfully approved by four states, including North Dakota and the United States Army Corps of Engineers. All supporters and opponents of the project had the equal right to voice their opinions on the project and engage in a civil debate regarding the merits of the pipeline, including in three public hearings held outside and throughout the state. The actions of those protesting the project has created an environment that is not only unsafe for our men," they're talking about the people that are building the pipeline, "and women, but also for law enforcement and the protesters themselves." This is labor leaders, and I'm going to tell you who they are. James P. Hoffa, leader of the Teamsters. Terry O'Sullivan, all right? William, he's the president of LUNA. I'm not sure which union that is. James T. Callahan, I believe he's the general president of Carpenters. Here's the point. You got their names. Go Google it yourself. William P. Height, his name is, general president of UA. So here you have labor leaders calling on the state to intensify their oppression against these Indians and prevent them from protesting. They don't care if you got your little sign and you're saying, "I'm saving myself for the Lord, dink, dink." But when you stand in front of them and prevent them from carrying out their program of destruction, then it's a different matter, you see. It's direct action, and that's what they don't want. Oh, man. So this problem remains with us, and Mr. Obama, bless us, it's really sad to say letting it play out is not the answer. And I can tell you what he's not going to do. He's not going to stop it. He's not going to say not one word against it because of that $3.8 billion. They are his master. He is the CEO of American capitalism, and he will act thusly. Good news. That struggle is not over, so don't give up. Don't give up the fight. A sister by the name of Yvette Farlaka, a union teacher in the Berkeley Unified School District, was fired a couple of months ago for participating in an anti-fascist rally in Sacramento. At that rally, a fascist organization, June 26th of this year, was trying to bring together the KKK, the Nazis, the National Socialists, all the little right-wing groups, and forged them together into one powerful National Socialist or Nazi organization. I joined with the people that said, we can't have this. We're not going to stand there and watch these people organize. Run them off! That's right. Run them off. Prevent them from organizing. We organized 500 people to meet them in Sacramento. We broke up their rally and ran them out of Sacramento. Now, here's the problem. This did not happen without consequences. There were casualties. Over 10 of our people were stabbed. It was ugly. These Nazis got prison connections, and we'll talk about that later on too, because we got people here with us that know all about these right-wing cliques that operate in the prisons. And these youngsters just ran at them raw and didn't understand who they were dealing with, and many of them were injured. One little brother was stabbed 5 times, almost lost his life. But in it all, you can't fight without consequences. You can't struggle without some casualties. Stopping those Nazis from organizing and running them out of town was a victory for the working people. You see what we're up against, these labor leaders conspiring against us, supporting the powers that be. That's what they're doing. They're conspiring against the people. Because whether you support the Indians' cultural, manifestations or not, they are water protectors. They're trying to help you. And the sooner we get that straight in our heads, the sooner we will support them. I can't go to North Dakota, but I go to whatever support rallies in this area to show support for what they're doing. So anyway, back to Yvette. So Yvette showed up at the rally. She got stabbed and hit. And this crazy fool was out there swinging. She didn't even know she was stabbed. She kept swinging and fighting and carrying on. And, well, I'm going to tell you something. They stomped one of these Nazis. And I'm sorry, but there are some among us who are pacifists. And what is a pacifist? Is a person that doesn't believe that violence should ever be used by anybody. Well, I'll be a pacifist the day we smash the capitalist state and no longer have violence against the working people and black people. Then I'll be a pacifist. But right now, I support what she did. But more importantly, I supported her right to be at the rally. She was fired for being at the rally. So as you may know, I'm a member of the Oscar Grant Committee Against Police Brutality and State Repression. And we supported her. We worked with her. And we got her job back. Now it's small. But it's a victory. Every small, that's what we need. Victory. Got to have the victories. Got to pile them up and let them know that we ain't going to stand there and let them just do anything to us. First of all, how do you fire somebody for something they did when they wasn't at work? But all in all, the reason it was so inspiring, y'all, is because when I went to the Berkeley Unified School District meetings, I saw the children. And these kids were from, one was early as 10 years old, all the way up to 17, because she's been teaching for 10 years. And these kids came to support their teacher. And that touched me. That really touched me, man. Because you don't see kids stepping up for their teachers that much. But these kids came to that meeting, and they explained why she was a good teacher. But what's really important is that you understand we won. We can win. But you have to struggle. You have to step up. So there you go. I'll come right back to you. Okay. That was just a couple of briefs around what's going on. John, you ready? You see, I always have music playing in the background. I turn it up. Okay. That's right. Thank you. You know what? You want to come here? Okay. All right. So we have Brother John Henneberry in the studio with us now. And he is a former member of Occupy Oakland, as I am. I was very active with Occupy Oakland. I was in the shutdown committee that organized the shutdown of the ports November 4th of 2011. Was that, John? Was I right?
Yes, I think that's right.
Okay. Speak up on that. Come closer to that mic.
Oh, it's better.
Make sure I can hear you. Let me hear you.
Better?
Yes,
that,
there
okay.
you go.
Okay, all right.
And I was also a member of the Education Committee and the Labor Solidarity Committee. Now, John came up with some very interesting suggestions that, unfortunately, now that I look back, we didn't catch a lot of people stepping up for this. And this was, John, your suggestion that we challenge the DA in Alameda County. Could you explain, please?
Yes. What's been happening in Alameda County, the district attorney's office, it is an elected position. They're required to run for election every 4 years.
As the sheriff is.
As the sheriff. Mm-hmm. Typically, though, they resign in the middle of their term when they're ready to retire. And under those circumstances, the Alameda County Board of Supervisors appoints their replacement. By the time the election rolls around, they then have incumbent advantage, and typically they run unopposed. This is the case with District Attorney Nancy O'Malley.
Hold on 1 second. Can I give a little historical context here? See, I want you to remember, where did the Oscar Grant Committee come from? Oscar Grant was murdered January the 1st, 2009. After kind of getting myself in order, not just me, but we established a defense committee, or a committee to publicize, one, support his family, and two, help coordinate this struggle. And that was the struggle going on in Oakland at that time. Now, if you remember, John, and you correct me because you might remember some of the facts better than I do, the DA of Alameda County at that time, what was his name again? The guy that preceded Nancy O'Malley.
I don't know. I was out of
there.
State,
you go. So. But I remember the bastard. I'm sorry. All right. It's Sunday. You know, I don't want to offend people, you know, that are listening. But he's a bastard in the following sense. This cat got cut his spurs oppressing the Panthers. This is how long he had been around, messing with us when we were trying to organize in the late 60s and 70s. That's where Orloff, Tom Orloff. How could I be? You know what, though, y'all? I'm struggling, man. I'm doing the best I can. Tom Orloff. And when it became clear that the community was not going to let this cat, the cop that shot Oscar Grant in the back, we wasn't going to let that go, that we demanded that they indict him and prosecute him. Tom Orloff loved the police so much, he resigned before he would press charges against Mesley. Johann Mesley is the man that shot Oscar Grant in the back. I can never forget that. That's how Nancy O'Malley became the district attorney for Alameda County. Go ahead, please.
Okay. So I originally got involved with this because I was part of the Bush prosecution. I'll just touch on that, and then I'll move on to the next thing. I was on this show a couple years ago. We do have the authority to prosecute George W. Bush and his co-conspirators for the deaths of the 11 Alameda County residents that were killed in Iraq. It's a murder case. This case was put together by Vince Bugliosi. He's best known as the person that prosecuted Manson. What most people don't know about Vince is that his career conviction rate as a prosecutor is 105 out of 106 felony jury trials, not plea bargain agreements. He's widely regarded as the most effective prosecutor in American history.
Hold on a second. I'm sorry, John. Just relax. Okay. I know, you know, he's talking about some stuff that's starting to wake me up now, and I just want to, once again, provide some context, historical context. This Manson character was a crazy cult leader in the 60s, and he had this whole group, and they wound up murdering a famous actress. Her name again?
Sharon Tate.
Yes. And the name of the DA, again,
Vince Bugliosi.
Bugliosi wrote an excellent book that I read called Helter Skelter. And when I read that book, I was so shocked because he was a very intelligent man, and he was showing how sick, racist, and incompetent the actual police and sheriff departments are. For instance, let me just give you one small fact. In the course of this case, which became very, it was on the television all the time. It was something that was, you know, people were looking at regularly. The sheriff's department in the city where that woman was killed had the murder weapon. And because they originally thought it wasn't going to be a big thing, they actually disposed of the murder weapon. And he had to go through all these changes to finally recover that, because that was a key piece of evidence. How do you dispose of a murder weapon on any case?
Yeah.
And I just, but I, after reading his book, Helter Skelter, I had enormous respect for him as a thinking DA. Continue, please.
Yeah. And comment on that. I finally got around to reading Helter Skelter. And from what I remember, the police that investigated the Tate-LaBianca killings rose up through the ranks before Los Angeles even had a police academy. They were incompetent. Vince was the one that did the investigation and broke the case. Manson was like last on the list of suspects. He's very smart. So we want to move on to the Bush prosecution. Most people, there's a lot of misunderstandings about it. It is not a war crimes case. We don't have the jurisdiction to prosecute Bush and his co-conspirators for war crimes in here in Alameda County, but we can prosecute him for murder, and that's due to the effects doctrine. The effects doctrine says that if a crime is committed outside the territorial jurisdiction of the state but has injurious effects within the state, then the state has the authority to prosecute. So it'd be a combination of California Penal Codes 187, murder, and 182, which is conspiracy. So that's how I first got involved with the effort to replace District Attorney Nancy O'Malley. I later learned that there's a lot of things that Nancy O'Malley was neglecting. She was neglecting to prosecute police officers that were murdering people. And though the Bush prosecution is a local option for the DA, prosecuting the police that are murdering people is not a local option. It's a necessity. She's remiss in her responsibilities. She needs to be replaced. There's no two ways about it. So she was appointed by the Alameda County Board of Supervisors when her predecessor resigned midterm, and she was forced to run for re-election. I believe this was, 2010, was it? And then she ran unopposed. Then I got involved in the effort. We did have an ad hoc committee set up to hopefully recruit somebody that would want to run against Nancy O'Malley. We did have a platform. Things on the platforms items were such as restorative justice, getting people that were responsible for crimes to understand their crimes, to make things right with their victims. That was more sensible than just the, you know, revolving door. Some other things, obviously, probably top on the list here would be to prosecute police that are murdering people. And one of the people we need to prosecute is the police officer that murdered Alan Bluford.
Hold on one second, please. I'm sorry. This one I have to speak. In fact, John, you were also a member of the Alan Bluford Support Committee, were you not?
I was part of the coalition. Yeah.
That's right. And this case, we spent some time in this case, and we laid some serious blows on the city of Oakland. Now, just to let you know, poor little Alan, I'm sorry. I mean, I don't know what to say, man. This young man was hanging out with his friends late at night, waiting for some girls, you know. And the police ran up on him, and this is the way they do to young people. He didn't just very calmly drive up at maybe 5-10 miles an hour and then, you know, ask the young man, excuse me, may I have a word with you, you know, respectfully. No, he turned that car around and he eased up on that curb, probably around something like 30 miles an hour. You heard the screech and he said, hands up, you know, causing panic. And those children, they didn't know what's going on here. So they split up and they got to run in, Jack. They got to run in. And Allen was a football player, so he really got to run in. This cop chased that child, and they wound up in East Oakland in front of a house owned by a Mexican family. And he took out his weapon, and listen to this. I know this pig shot himself. Literally, when we make fun, we say you shoot yourself in the foot. He took his weapon out, shot himself, and now he mad, and turned around, and Allen said, what did I do? Bam, killed him, right there. And then, of course, now let me show you something. For those interested in real history, the Oakland police changed their story 7 times. The first story they put out was that Allen, when they shot Allen, now you got to have a justification for it, right? So the other pigs came, and they looking at the situation, intimidating the Mexicans inside their house, and they took a throwdown, that is a weapon, right? And they threw it not too far from Allen's body, within 20 feet of his dead body.
And Gerald, you remember where that weapon was traced?
Please.
It was traced, reportedly, it was stolen in a burglary from a police officer's home in Mountain House.
Mighty convenient, huh? Now look, that's why, thank you, John. Thank you so much. But I just want people to understand, you know, this struggle. The struggle against police brutality ain't just about throwing bottles and, I don't want FTP, that's the word that they use. And I understand hatred and anger against the police, and I understand that's justified, but we gotta do better, y'all. We can't just get mad. We have to learn how to win a struggle, to stay with it. So I remember we fought. They tried to keep us from reading the coroner's report, because the first thing they had to do was they had to straighten up that lie about Allen shot the policeman in the foot. Why? Because the hospitals would not cooperate with the police. So the hospitals told us that bullet that went into his foot was from a policeman's weapon. They lied. Now, right there, you think they locked that person up. He done lied. They done caught him lying. Why did they not lock him up? Because they don't want to punish their murderers, their thugs. I'm sorry, John.
Yeah. So anyway, other items about the narrative. Miguel Masso, he was the police officer that murdered Alan Bluford. Before he gave chase, his body camera was turned on, and then he turned it off as soon as he started chasing him. Another problem was that we know from the Oscar Grant killing that the police do not have the right to remain silent. Johann Messerly was forced to resign in order to remain silent. Miguel Masso did not take that option, so he talked afterwards, and if he told the truth, he'd be prosecuted for murder. So the story he told, well, first off, people heard shots. No one knew who was doing the shooting, and as it turned out, Miguel Masso was the only person that knew that he was the only person that did the shooting, and he refused to say this, so it was a lie by omission right off the get-go from Miguel Masso. The story he told to investigators was when he shot Allen was standing, fell against a fence, and then shot a couple more times. Basically, start to finish, the 4 shots were fired, according to Masso, in probably around 10 seconds, based on his narrative. The problem was, Miguel Masso literally shot himself in the foot, and the 3 other rounds struck Alan Bluford. It took about a year of legal wrangling for the attorneys for the Bluford family to get the shot spotter report, which is an audio recording of the shots that were fired. And a year later, we learned that all four shots were fired in a span of 1.4 seconds. So in order for one round to strike Miguel Masso in the foot and the other three rounds to hit Alan Bluford in the chest, Miguel Masso would have had to be standing over Alan Bluford, and Alan Bluford would have had to been laying on the ground in order for four shots to be fired in that way in 1.4 seconds. Miguel Masso lied. He lied by omission at the beginning, and then a year later, we learned that he told a direct lie to investigators. If you read reports that are that the mainstream media issues, they gloss everything over, and what's happening is if the police tell a story that a third grader would not believe, the district attorney says, good enough for us, and they don't prosecute. To make a long story short, there was more than sufficient evidence to require Miguel Masso to defend himself in court, and that never happened.
And now I think with some of that as context, can you understand, some of us, and I feel a little guilty about this, but some of us ridiculed John when he came forward and said, we need to run for sheriff, we need to run for DA. People looked at John and said, man, you crazy. Somebody run. I don't want to be no damn pig. But you see, here's the mistake. These are elected offices. If you don't challenge them everywhere, you can't just, they kill somebody, we have our march, we out there, we frustrated, we throw a bottle, we chant FTP, FTP, and that doesn't mean free the people. and what happens? What is the result of this? I guess we let off some anger. That's like a safety valve for capitalism. But all told, the pig, still a pig, still got his job, and they still murdering us. Why does the 1% allow pigs, and I mean it, pigs, to murder unarmed citizens and then get away with it? It is a form of police terror, and they need it, because what are they offering our young people today? What kind of society are they growing up into? What kind of opportunities in life stand before them? I tell you what, it's not much, man. So they need that terror to keep people in line. Kill one, terrorize millions. And that's what they do. And it's sad. But we have to learn, in my humble opinion, y'all, to fight them on every single front. And part of that means that we have to admit when we make a mistake. We have to reevaluate what we're doing. Can we do better? Can we improve?
Yes, if there's enough support. Okay, we've got to work at it. In order to be qualified to run for district attorney, you've got to be a member of the California State Bar. In order to run for sheriff of Alameda County, you've got to have completed post-training, which is police officers. I believe it stands for police officers, standards, and training. Sheriff Greg Ahern controls, I believe, the second largest jail in America. I think that's the number for Santa Rita. He has a huge budget, and he always appears on the ballot unopposed. So we're looking for some progressives to run against these people, but as I've been telling everybody, the problem in finding candidates to oppose them is no progressive wants to be a cop. We understand that, but the alternative is even worse. We've got people that are doing some really lousy stuff, basically committing civil rights violations, human rights violations, and are going unopposed, appearing on the ballot unopposed, not giving the people a choice. And the truth is not coming out. The media is not telling the people the full story. So, just back to the Bush prosecution, just for a second.
Can you just explain for a minute now? Because you know your facts, yeah. But explain to the listening audience the basis for the suit. Because I don't like Bush. A lot of us don't like Bush, but some of us feel that it's fantastic. How do you charge the president of the United States with murder? How could you do that? Please explain.
Yeah, sure. Again, remember that the research was done and the case was put together by Vince Bugliosi. Vince isn't with us anymore. He died last year, but his work does live on. Again, he's widely regarded as the, or was widely regarded as the most effective prosecutor in American history. So this is not a radical concept. Sadly, it is mainstream, and that's because the crime was so horrific. I don't want to take up too much time, but I'm trying to deliver a two-minute summary here of the case. In the run-up to the 2003 invasion of Iraq, there was a national intelligence estimate for the threat that Iraq posed to America. There's, I believe, 16 different intelligence agencies contributed to this report, and their conclusion was that Iraq was not an imminent threat to America. And one of the quotes in the conclusion was that Iraq would not attack America unless it was attacked first. The issue of weapons of mass destruction, there's a lot of confusion about that or misunderstanding. The presence or absence of weapons of mass destruction does not justify an invasion. So whether or not we believe they had anything is not the case. Because remember, countries such as France, Israel, and North Korea are all known as a fact to have weapons of mass destruction, but we don't invade them because our intelligence services tells us that these countries are not an imminent threat. And that's the only justification for killing somebody, is they have to be an imminent threat, not the weapons. Okay, so this, the national intelligence estimate said that Iraq's not an imminent threat. Despite this, the White House created a 25-page document known as a white paper. In that paper that was submitted to Congress, all dissenting opinions from the national intelligence estimate were omitted. So Congress got a one-sided story. Congress was lied to. And they gave Bush and his people war authority. Okay, any county that is the home of record for soldiers that were killed in Iraq has the authority to prosecute George W. Bush and his co-conspirators for murder. And again, this is due to the effects doctrine. The prosecution will be privately funded. It will not cost any county, any money. All we need is the district attorney's signature. This is legal. So that's the case. There was, there's been efforts in various parts of the country to get this done. As far as the damage caused by the war, as a reminder, approximately 5,000 Americans were killed. I don't know if it was 10 or 20 times as many Americans were maimed and seriously injured as a result of the war. According to the Lancet survey, which is based on the world's best medical journal, approximately 1 million people in the country formerly known as Iraq were killed as a result of the U.S.-led invasion. Probably five times as many were displaced. And there's a war going on to this day in the Mideast resulting from the 2003 invasion. According to our own Congressional Budget Office, the war in Iraq will have cost America $1.9 trillion when you factor in health care for returning veterans. This is through the year 2017. So the price tag for the war is already about $2 billion. This was arguably the biggest crime in American history. The crime has been solved, and the suspects have been named, and again, the prosecution will be privately funded.
Can you just tell us how much money do you think, we know the lives. Lives, you can't count in money. But just in terms of money, wasn't it over $1 trillion spent on this invasion of Iraq?
Sure. According to our Congressional Budget Office, again, this is government data. Through the year 2017, it will cost the American taxpayer $1.9 trillion, approximately $2 trillion. And, of course, that would provide a lot of health care, public housing, education. And that takes a backseat to all the death injuries and misery that the war caused.
Well, you know what? I mean, all of what you're saying is important, but let's zero in now on your impending victory against the Alameda County DA's office with this matter, because you will be welcome back again, but we have other guests that we're going to have to really give them a little room to stretch out too. So make sure you explain, because I want people to know that there's no such thing as a hopeless situation, that you can always fight back. So why don't you tell us about this situation where they framed you up, screwed you around, and now they're going to have to pay.
Well, I hope they'll have to pay. I'm still fighting it, and I'll give you a little background on the case. I guess I've got about 10 minutes before the next person comes on. Okay. In 2014, I was the victim of a property crime, and basically someone stole my car. I call it an illegal towing. I call it grand theft. And the police and this other person were unhappy that I did not say please and thank you to the person that stole my car. About a week after the incident, the police came to my house, knocked on the door, and wanted to ask me about this incident. And I came out of my house and talked to them, because I wanted to tell them, I said, as long as you're here, let me tell you about this guy that just stole my car. I told them, and then without my knowledge, the police submitted a police report to the Alameda County District Attorney. Didn't know this happened. And also in this report, the police provided the district attorney with my correct address, including the correct apartment number. The district attorney's office then prepared a criminal summons and mailed it to my house, and conveniently mailed it to the wrong apartment number, despite the fact that they had the right information. Now, according to the California Penal Code, a summons cannot be sent by mail. It must be served by a sworn peace officer or an officer of the court. It must be personally served. That way people know that they've been summoned to court. I had no idea I'd been summoned to court because I never got the letter. It'd been sent to the wrong address. The court date came and went, and then on July 2nd, 2014, which was just before the long holiday weekend, the police sent the anti-gang squad to my house, and they told me that they had a warrant for my arrest. I asked them what the warrant was for, and they just told me assault. They took me away, took me directly to Santa Rita, and I spent the next 7 days in Santa Rita. I was never taken to court. I brought prescription medication with me, just some eye drops I take for treating glaucoma. That was seized from me, which they have to because it was open, but they never gave it to me. I kept complaining I need this medication. After all the smoke cleared, it turns out they used that as an excuse to put me on a medical hold to keep me from going to court. A relative bailed me out of jail. I asked them not to do that, but they bailed me out of jail. And I learned that I was facing a single misdemeanor charge of assault. Now, to remind people, assault and battery are two separate crimes as codified by the California Penal Code. Assault is sometimes described as a threat or a swing and a miss. Now, battery means you actually make physical contact with somebody. No one accused me of making physical contact with anybody because I was never charged with battery. I was dragged through the court system for approximately 2 years, 30 different court appearances, including a 2.5-week jury trial that resulted in a hung jury. DA refiled charges and added a trespassing charge, and then they dismissed the whole thing. So after 2 years, I was convicted of absolutely nothing as a result of this. Now, the problem was that I was denied my Fifth Amendment right to due process, as well as some other things, because the law is clear that a summons could not be sent by mail. It must be personally served. What's interesting is, I do have the summons here. It was a simple one-page document written on letterhead from the Alameda County District Attorney, and it's signed by a man named John Jay. It's an interesting name because that's the name of America's first Supreme Court justice way back when. John Jay was an assistant district attorney. To remind people, we have the district attorney. She has about 10 assistant district attorneys, and below that are maybe 100 deputy district attorneys. So an assistant district attorney is fairly high ranking. John Jay went to work for the Alameda County DA's office in 1979 before he was even a lawyer. Passed the bar, and that's the only job he's ever had. He had a 35-year career with the Alameda County District Attorney's Office. He's worked as a law professor, and he mailed me a summons in clear violation of California statutes. He claims he doesn't know any better. So I filed, after all the smoke cleared, before the statute ran out, the two-year statute ran out, I filed a lawsuit in federal court in the Northern District of California. There's 15 defendants named, four entities, and I think I've got the list right here. There's about 15 individuals named, four entities, and there's 20 claims, which in federal court, that's the equivalent of causes of action. So 20 different claims. Our time's limited, so I won't name them all here, but I sued them for things such as fraud, kidnapping, violating my Fifth Amendment right to due process, violating my Fourth Amendment right to not be seized, violating my Sixth Amendment right because while I was at trial, a deputy district attorney announced that he conferred with his boss and they contacted our defense witnesses that had been properly subpoenaed and told them not to appear in court. That violates our Sixth Amendment right to call witnesses, and I also sued them for violating my 14th Amendment right to equal treatment under the law.
Now, hold on, John.
Yeah.
You're not a lawyer, are you?
No, I'm not.
But you took your basic understanding of the law, and you use that to defend yourself right now.
Yes.
That is commendable.
Yeah, I'm a plaintiff in pro se. Sometimes it's called pro per plaintiffs and pro ses. So I could talk more about this. The kidnapping case is interesting because they use the United States mail to send this to me, and I consider that mail fraud. They help commit fraud. In 1970, Congress passed Anti-Organized Crime Act. I forget the name of it. I don't have my notes in front of me. But that led to the RICO statutes, racketeer-influenced and corrupt organizations. The RICO statutes were designed to purge legitimate organizations of their criminal elements. And corporations use these in civil cases to sue. One corporation will sue another corporation for violating interstate commerce, interstate patent violations, infringement, things like this. And doing the research, I found that there are certain... Well, first off, a private individual does not have a right to action to sue somebody under sections of Title 18, which is the federal criminal code, which includes kidnapping. But there are exceptions. If there's a predicate act, an individual can under the RICO laws. And one of the predicate acts is a pattern of mail fraud. So I'm trying to establish that the DA is committing a pattern of mail fraud, mailing these summonses out to people. People don't show up, and then the judge issues an order for failure to appear. No bail bench.
In other words, you are not the only person that they have done this to.
Yeah, and we can prove this because I went to a hearing in court for the defense's motions to dismiss the case, and the lawyer for Alameda County volunteered in court that the county, as a matter of procedure, mails criminal summonses to people. He admitted that in court.
Hold on. Slow down, man. Slow down. See, the reason we have John here now is not because we're just generally interested in the broken American judicial system, but it's to give our listeners some imagination as to what is possible if you pay attention to legal procedures. Continue, John.
Okay. And one more reason why I think mailing these summonses are fraud, because on this simple one-page summons that summoned me to court, which, by the way, I got my hands on after I got out of jail. I went down to the courthouse and asked if they had mailed me something, and they produced this in about 5 minutes. The simple one-page summons, at the bottom of the page, is the Declaration of Service by Mail, and it looks very official if you're not paying attention, because in parentheses it says CCP 101-3A, etc., etc. CCP is the California Code of Civil Procedure. This does not apply to criminal prosecutions. What applies...
Civil cases.
What applies is the California Penal Code.
Just very quickly, yeah. People should know there's a difference between criminal and civil.
Yeah.
All right? Please explain very quickly.
Yeah, so anyway, the district attorney only gets involved in criminal prosecutions, and there's a section of the Penal Code which directs the district attorney in the proper way to serve a summons, and it must be personally served by a police officer. Well, the civil code says it can be served by mail. The only problem was, this was not a civil prosecution. It is a big lie and a giant fraud, and again, they said, their own attorney in court said, we do this all the time.
Oh, man. Go ahead, bro.
So, to wrap it up here, all 20 claims were dismissed by Magistrate Judge Elizabeth D. LaPorte on October 12th, and since then, I have filed the appeal with the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals.
All right, well, John, we here at Slave Revolt, I don't have my whole crew here with me today, but we certainly wish you well, because I can see that when a person like you can call them for accounts, if we can get this information out, because they regularly disregard the rights of black people. I know. I mean, I don't want to get through my whole list of wrongdoings that we found. But this is evidence, brothers and sisters, as to why we need to pay attention to what they do to us legally. There is a possibility of fighting back if and only if you know your rights. Thank you very much, John.
Okay, thanks.
Okay, so now we're going to switch off now and start talking about a meeting that I was fortunate enough to go to. But right now, let's just listen. I want to give you, you know what? John Coltrane, Alabama, and we'll be right back.
Thank you.
Okay, we're back. Yeah, we're back. And yeah, I'm very, very, very honored to have in the studio Living History, Brother Watani. Did I pronounce that right, brother? Brother Watani Steiner, who describes himself as a COINTELPRO survivor. So first, before we define that, I just want to tell you how we hooked up so everybody knows on the up and up. Last night, I went to a prison focus forum at the First Congregational Church, 2501 Harrison. And I was, the reason I went, you want to know the truth? It's because of you. The reason I went is because I saw Brother, I said, my goodness, I've never seen this brother speak. I've never heard, you know, any explanation except what I've heard from pro-Panther propaganda or, you know, historical analysis. So I said, you know what, you got to go and you got to listen, bro. That's how you learn, you listen. So the event was actually quite interesting. It included a brother, Brother Ray Raymond, who talked about his experience being tried as an adult when he was a youth. We just voted against that, y'all. Hopefully that's going to slow him down a little bit. You can't try children as adults. And then we had, what was this, the other brother? Brother Troy Williams, who spent a considerable amount of time in prison and but was affiliated with one of the street organizations, what they call gangs, the street organizations in L.A., and wound up spending, you know, decades behind bars. And, well, you know, honesty matters. Sometimes you don't want to be totally honest, so I have to say, my conscience tells me to say that I was a member of a street organization in New York, the Mighty Disciples in the South Bronx, New York. That's where I dwell. We in 1841, the Mighty Disciples that had just begun. We were some bad, yes indeed, some bad from Trinity, you know. Hi Lord, the Hubbard de Bode, you know. Yeah, I was affiliated myself, and but through the grace of God and my grandmother, I just never went off the deep end and got caught up in the prison thing myself. Now, Brother Watani, you were a member of the United Slaves Organization, is that right?
I'm sorry.
Okay, you know what? What you got to do now is you got to speak a little, or keep, it's two things, either speak louder or get that microphone right up on you, because we want to make sure that we hear you properly, all right?
Yes, okay.
Continue, please.
Yeah, so anyway, I just wanted to make that that clear, because a lot of publication has also used the term United Slave, but we've never referred to ourselves, and I don't think we would ever refer to ourselves as United Slaves.
You know what? Now here, just on the simplest little thing, out the gate, people got it wrong. Because I'm going to tell you, I am an avid student of history. I study, and I read the stuff, and I think I know, because I read the stuff. But here's the question. E.H. Carr wrote a book called What is History? And in that book, he explains that when you study history, you have to be cognizant of who is writing that history, because that's what you're getting. You're getting a perspective, history from a particular perspective. And the academic histories that I have read have literally never made that point. And that is, brother, I'm going to get it right, Watani just pointed out that actually us was us. And this United... But all right, Smarty, where did it come from? Where did that... I find it almost... where did that myth that that U.S. or us meant United slaves?
I think it came out of the whole concept of the COINTELPRO propaganda that started to drive the wedge in the movement and separate the organization. So they came up with this pejorative term, United Slaves. And it sort of went on for a while, and it just regurgitated to, in the news. I think that lately it's been sort of challenged. I think people that did research in the study, and they found out that the first time it came out was within the media, and it was something that the establishment kept propagating. So people, I think a lot of people just didn't know, and they just picked it up and started using United Slaves as if that was the name. But it's always been us, never United Slaves.
Well, thank you for that. Let's start off with the truth. Now, I'm going to share with you my little, humble understanding, and I need you, because you're going to correct me. And now, I don't want you to get me wrong here. None of us is smart as all of us. The reason I brought you here was to straighten out the historical record, to tell the truth to the youth so they can raise the roof. But let's raise the right part of the roof here, not raise it and let it crumble on us. So, one, United Slaves is a myth. So right out the gate. But there was a difference, though. Watabi, there was a difference. Watani, excuse me. There was a difference, and that is... That is it appropriate to describe us as a Milana Ron Karenga as a cultural nationalist organization?
I think that would be correct.
Okay,
we were a cultural nationalist organization. Yeah.
So one of the differences that actually did occur is that when I joined the Panthers, in my understanding, I was like 17, so let's was that we considered ourselves a revolutionary nationalist organization. We were involved in our community, and we started off, actually, the name of our organization at birth was the Black Panther Party for Self-Defense. That's what we actually started off as. Now, there are certain problems that you inherit with that posture. Because when people think of the Panthers today, when our young people think of the Panthers, they see the brother with the foreboding rifle in his hands and the dark glasses and the tam tilted on his head, the militaristic image, okay? And you know what, man? We better start learning to be honest about that. Because is our struggle against this system primarily a military struggle? I would argue that every struggle is going to have its military phase, but it is primarily a political struggle. You have to gather your forces. You have to train your cadre. There's a lot of things that you might want to do before you call yourself picking up a gun to deal with imperialist United States. So we're not disrespecting anyone to try to keep a level head here about what next. What are we going to do? What can we learn here so that we can rebuild the Black Liberation Movement? So in LA at that time, to my remembrance, we had the Black Congress was going on. Okay, go get right on there. Tell me about the...
Yeah, okay, before I get into Black Congress, let me just say a little bit about the difference between cultural nationalism and what they call revolutionary nationalism. that also was a myth of propaganda that was put forth by the media and that was fanned by COINTELPRO, because there's no distinction between cultural nationalism and political nationalism or revolutionary nationalism, we say. It's a false concept, because cultural nationalism, we say that the revolution being fought now is a revolution to win the hearts and minds of our people. And after that revolution, I mean, that revolution is essential, is crucial in any struggle. So it's not in opposition to revolutionary nationalism, but revolution, if we talk about revolutionary, we're talking about a process, you know, and the area of interest we're talking about is culture. So cultural nationalism is part and parcel of the same thing, whether you talk about religious nationalism or you talk about you just name any other nationalism that you put your emphasis. Our emphasis was on culture. Culture nationalism in terms of trying to win the hearts and minds of the people. And we focus on identity, purpose, and direction. So, I mean, I think it's so crucial that we really look at history and look at what was done and how this wedge was driven into the movement to separate us and thinking that we're having two different struggles when it's one struggle, even if we have a different approaches. And we're talking about ideological differences. We have ideological differences. We had ideological differences even with, you know, the NAACP. You know, you can name the CORE. They focus on certain things. SNCC. They focus on, it doesn't baffle me, but it makes me more energized to try to address this issue and to get into the dialogue with, like, I'm so grateful that we have in this conversation, because there's so much things that we're talking about 50 years that we've been struggling here, and we have to pass something on to the younger generation, and we can't just pass that we were just this, you know, revolutionary movement and we did this and we had these challenges, we had these shootouts and stuff. There's some mistakes, some weaknesses that we make, and we have to pass that on to the next generation. We have to pass the historical baton on to the next generation, not just part of the baton, but the whole baton. And that's what I feel that my role. Now, back to the Black Congress, since we can deal. The Black Congress was the umbrella of many different organizations. We had SNCC, we had CORE, we had the Black Panthers, we had the US organization, you know, we had the Brothers Crusade. I mean, it was a collection of all the organization that was gathered in
there. You know what? I'm so happy. I don't know what to do here. You got to understand, rarely do I. Now, one, we don't agree on everything. So let's know. You know that, but I don't feel competitive. I don't feel that we don't agree on everything. Does that make us enemies? I don't agree on everything with Black people that are Christians. Are they our enemies? Of course not. And this is a very important political thing that we have to get, that we should never view people that do not agree with us as our enemies, because that is something that was exploited by the FBI when they set us into attack mode on each other. For instance, now I was in New York, all right, and there was a Black Arts Movement. Now, you want to know something? Many of the Black Panthers were a part of that Black Arts Movement. So Black Panthers were involved in the Black Arts in what? Culture. Out here in the Bay Area, there was something called the Black Caucus that was set up by the Black Panthers. And that Black Caucus was active in trade union work, Muni. What is the famous Black poet? And Still I Rise. What is that sister's name again?
Maya
Angelou was part of our work there when she was driving the Muni bus at the time. Now I'm going all the way back. See, is Maya Angelou our enemy? No. Enemy is the 1%, is the oppressor, the exploiter. In our community, there is a range of political differences that we must learn to understand, learn to respect each other, and have a reasonable discussion and acknowledge, you know, no, we don't agree on that point or this. Because over time, you know what happens? We change our minds. We grow. We improve. And eventually, we will be one. And when that happens, Babylon, your ass, your time is up, baby. And that's what we should all be working towards. You see? I'm sorry to cut you off. I just wanted to make that point. One, I do have a different approach. But go back to your, go back to the story of the early Black Congress in L.A. Because I thought it was a very interesting phenomenon. In fact, what we're seeing is that the Black Panthers, us, CORE, the Congress of Racial Equality, SNCC, Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee, were all working together. And you mentioned another organization, the Crusade.
Yeah, Brotherhood Crusade.
Okay.
But yeah, they had several other organizations, a little small organization that also. So everyone was gathered together under this umbrella at the Black Congress. And the US organization came into existence like a year before the Black Panthers on the West Coast. That was in L.A. And I remember, and I was present there too, when we held at what we call the Hay Collar, which was our headquarters, we held a rally for the Free Huey rally. And that's sometimes that's hardly
mentioned.
Mentioned, yeah.
In other words, us supported Huey Newton winning his freedom after he was arrested. Is that right?
Exactly. Not only supported, but we held it, and we held it at the headquarters we have, which was the Black Congress. So I'm this, and Erica Hugg and I talked about this a lot, and we have photographs and showing how unity was there. We even had, I remember we had a peace treaty with, I don't know if anyone knows, at Ace Tiarina. He was, I always call him, he was in from New Mexico. I always call him the radical version of Cesar Chavez, because they took over the courthouse and they demand land. Well, at the sports arena in L.A., we held a gathering which was a peace treaty. It was the Black Panthers, the Brown Berets, the US organization. Stokely spoke there, and we had, you know, so this was the time. It was 1968 too. And it's the time when we went to Albuquerque, New Mexico, and we, you know, we signed. I mean, we got signatures on this. I forgot, I don't know if it was in Spanish, UNITA or something. But it was a time where unity was there. Now, when I say that, I don't mean that we didn't have ideological differences. We had ideological differences. We should argue over different points, and, you know, but it never, the violent aspect of it, was introduced, I think, by external forces, and I think history bears that out. But the ideological differences, we can't, you know, I'm not trying to say we were all just, you know, kumbaya and no disagreement, because there was fierce disagreements, fierce ideological order in terms of what direction we would do. But in the end, particularly under the umbrella of the Black Congress, we would all come together in agreement on exactly how we're going to do. Some people would provide security, because we didn't really protest with signs, but we support teachers and other people who would protest. The Panthers, and both of us would be together, and we would provide joint security. You know, it'd be some posturing up there about, you know, who has the most military stance or militant pose and stuff. I mean, those things. And we have to keep in mind, too, we were all in our 20s, early 20s. We were young. We were focused on trying to bring about a fundamental change in this country in our own various different ways. But I know, I mean, this is just so, it's so important for people to know that is possible. Unity is possible. And I keep talking about it in terms of what kind of lessons do we pass on to the next generation. Because if we don't tell them the whole story, then we end up being of disservice to them. And this is something that I'm very passionate about.
Well, you're passionate about the right thing, brother, because here's the point. Young people coming up now don't have the advantage that you and I had. See, you might have me by a couple of years. We ain't that far apart on the age thing. But see, I remember when I was a child, the civil rights movement was already in motion. Millions of black people in the South were marching, demonstrating, protesting, struggling in every way they could to win their freedom. And that had an effect on the whole nation, particularly black people in the North. Now, myself, I went to the South every summer. It was involuntary. My family sent me down South to work on the farm because they didn't want me roaming the street. Okay? So I got to see firsthand kind of what was going on down there. So when I came back, I knew what I was supporting when I supported the struggle against segregation, against the illegal treatment of black people and the murder of black people in the South. Remember, Emmett Till. I was about the same age as Emmett Till when he got... No, I was younger than Emmett Till. But that stuck. That stuck. So you have a milieu. Here was a normal family dinner on Sunday. We having the family dinner. At age 10, I had a subscription to the New York Times. I'm not bragging. I'm trying to show y'all the difference in America and how we've gone downhill. They came in our school and gave us a discount for a subscription to the New York Times. Anybody wanted to pay a couple of dollars because they were optimistic. They wanted children to get into the system. They wanted us to get into reading their newspapers and, you know, and my family gave me the money to get that. I got it. So I would bring those articles to the dinner table on Sunday and my father would pick out what I should read. And I would read an article to the family before dinner because they were very proud of the fact that I could read, having come from the South. And it was usually, dig this, something about Cuba, Che Guevara, or Castro, or Malcolm X, or Lumumba. I remember. That's what they, and I would read that, and then the grown folks would get debating, and I'd be watching, and what? And learning. This was a normal, this wasn't my house like we some kind of special Negroes. This was a common reality at the time because the level of consciousness was much higher in the black community. Don't you think that's true?
Yeah, I definitely agree with you. And given a little history, I grew up in the Jim Crow South in Houston, Texas. You know, and I remember the segregated sections. I remember the not drinking drinking from certain water fountains. I remember going around to the door of a guy named Mr. Fontenot. I just had to go to the back door because we couldn't go to the front door. One thing I like to share that has a vivid image that even to this day, I remember we used to go to the beach and they had this long net. And in my child mind, it seemed like that net was going all the way across the whole ocean. You know, and I remember as a kid, we used to get up there and we used to peep through the little holes in the net and watching the white kids play in the sand. And they looked like they was having a whole lot of more fun than we were having. And I remember my mom say, "Y'all go play. You know, but, I mean, the whole world seems differently. And as a child, and I grew up Catholic, as a child, the only way that I could make sense of this world was through the eyes of a Catholic child, through the eyes of my religious faith. And everything to me seems normal because, you know, we couldn't drink from the white fountain because that was a sin. We couldn't go in the front door, Mr. Fontenot's door, because that was a sin. You know, so the only way I can do that is to do that. It would be a big black sin if I would do that. And why wouldn't it be? Because my parents, they were going for it. My uncles, everybody seemed like they're going for it. So it seemed so natural for me. So leaving there and going to California was a whole cultural shock for me in terms of what the world that I was entering into, you know, that changed up. And my whole world changed in California in 1965. And that's when they had the August Revolt that took place in August 11th, 1965.
In Watts.
Well, wasn't exactly in Watts, but Watts got the
crit,
thing because it was L.A. really, but Watts was the name that stuck in history.
And what effect did that have on you as a developing young person?
Okay, let me. Well, about me, when I at that time, now I was in 1965, I graduated from high school. I married my high school sweetheart. I got me a well-paying job at a major aircraft company called McDonnell Douglas. I'm about to become the proud father of my first son. All I needed was a house, white picket fence, and an obedient dog. And I would have been right. I was well on my way to becoming your first Huxtable, So when 1965 took place.
No, wait a minute. Just tell people, because some of our young people don't
Huxtable
know. You're talking about Bill Cosby's Huxtable, the model American dream family that has been on television. Yeah. Continue, please.
And so all this happened in 1965. And I just turned 17 when I got married. I was 3 months into my 17th birthday. I married my high school sweetheart. So when 1965 took place, that just shadowed my whole world. I mean, it sent some, it's almost like, I guess like the Black Lives Matter movement. When people say, Black Lives Matter, that is not just the organization. That resonates in people's mind because you actually, where does not Black Lives Matter? You go to the prison system, Black Lives Matter. Who's getting killed? Black Lives Matter. Unemployment? Black Lives Matter. So it resonates. Just like for us, in my generation, it was Black Power. Black Power was self-determination, self-respect, and self-defense. But Black Power was something that resonated. It wasn't connected to one particular organization or you try to figure out how to structure it. And so this was the thing that gave rise to my generation. So 1965, when that happened, I wanted to, I worked at McDonnell Douglas, and I was looking for an organization, and the US organization was the organization that captured my emotion, my dreams, my hope, and I gravitated to that. So much so that I went to my job, and I heard something about what was happening in Vietnam, and I got mad. I said, I'm not going to put my fingerprints on bombs that's going to kill, people in Vietnam. But I didn't think it through. But I went home and told my wife that. She said, you got to be out of your mind. Who's going to pay the bill? And I really didn't think about all that. I figured I could draw unemployment and I'd get a part-time job. So that shattered my marriage. I almost broke up my whole marriage, and I had to figure out something real quickly.
Now, hold on, bro. Let me just tell you this, because I went through a similar evolution. I graduated from, I went to Manhattan Community, then I went to City College. I graduated and I taught in public school. I got a little, because I had worked in the Panthers, we had the Martin Luther King Liberation School. So people said, you pretty good teacher, you can do this. So I went on and I started teaching in public school. I got disillusioned because of the alienation between the community and the administration in New York. And so I took it easy out. I went to work at a college, Bronx Community College, as an associate professor. So understand, and then when I got political, I quit that cushy-ass, sweet-ass job to go work in a factory and try to do my political thing. So understand, you ain't the only person on this planet that got down and did what you thought was right, even though it did not appear to be in your immediate material interest. Continue, please.
Okay, at that time when I quit my job, I wanted to go to Black Congress.
Get back on it. Yeah.
Oh. What am I doing? The Black okay. The Black Congress was, in motion because I didn't quit the job and I wanted to devote more time in the movement, in the struggle. And
so you were a real cadre of us.
I rose through the ranks, after.
How many members did y'all have back then?
We had, what did Malcolm say? Those who know don't. But anyway, let me see. We had We had various problems. We had, sometimes we had like 200, but our main focus was not so much in one organization. We believed in what we call programmatic influence. And what we do, we have organizations that we, you know, we work with, even though they don't have the name of us, but they were very active. And eventually we expanded. We had a branch in San Diego. And also, for what few people know, that Imam Baraka was also a member of the US organization on the East Coast in Newark. And that's a little known history. When I got back, I started trying to figure out, you know, it seemed like that's been moved out of history, because he was Imam Amiri Baraka. And we had three Imamos. We had Imam Sukumu, who was in San Diego. We had Imam Halisi, who was in L.A. And we had Imam Baraka, who was a part of the organization. And matter of fact, we went there several times. I was active in the Black Power Conference in 1968 in Philadelphia. And so, you know, I'm just saying this to give some kind of context, that things are just sort of, you know, snatched out of history, and people don't know the whole story about it. And it's
just, hold on just 1 minute, because I want to confirm something. Mm-hmm. Actually, it wasn't all that different with the Panthers. Because I mentioned the Black Caucus, didn't I?
Yeah.
Well, see, one of the things that the Black Caucus did, remember Murray was our minister of education, and I believe he was actually a teacher at San Francisco State. But we wound up forming the Third World Coalition, mm-hmm. that led the strike. That was not all Panthers. Mm-hmm. Maybe one out of four of those people might have actually been a party member.
Right.
But just as you talked about programmatic influence, so we influenced that coalition, and that wound up being the longest student strike in American history that established what? Ethnic studies departments, Black history. So isn't that cultural on a certain level? So, you know, here now, the more we look, the more we learn. So what were the actual, there were differences, by the way, but I mean, you see, this is what I'm, that the differences may have been, is something that rarely is discussed, actually. All we know about is the conflict and the violence. Continue, please.
Yeah, and just the point on the differences is important, I think, in any movement, ideological difference, because it causes you to either clarify your position, you know, understand other people's position. But those, I think that without that, I think the movement would be stagnant, you know. The violent part is a whole other thing, but having debates and arguments over important issues are important. And I think that's another thing we should also be able to pass on to the next generation, and not that it be infiltrated and turned into something else, or morphed into something something else. After I quit my job, I'm gonna just move along in terms of my journey. After I went to the Black Congress, where, you know, I enrolled in UCLA on the motion picture production program. Now, this was part of, it was, I guess we'd call it, forerunner to affirmative action. Yeah, before affirmative action, but it was a sort of affirmative action. Not that I was, you know, this bright guy and had all the credentials and I had all that. I had I had the revolutionary passion, and I had the organization and the Black Congress backing, and I had, you know, I had a direction. We were going to try to get the skills and stuff that we can get from the school. You know, so we saw, you know, getting a diploma or a degree as receipt for what you're doing. We were going in as cultural agents to try to get the skills so we can have something in order to serve the community.
Now, let me tell you something. That, unfortunately, became somewhat of a difference, because I'm going to show you. And In this case, I definitely support young people going to school and getting their degrees. So let's not make, but it is, the fact of the matter is, the Black Panther Party put itself forward. We developed this idea that we were going to organize the brothers in the street. And to us, even though everybody knows that, well, not everybody, people who carefully study our history knows the Black Panther Party was really born at Merritt College. Bobby and Huey met at Merritt College. They went on to form the Black Panther Party and come up with the theory of intercommunalism later on. That was Huey's theory. But this idea of organizing the brother in the street may have been the theory, but in fact, the initial cadre came from college.
Yeah, let me a little bit about the receipt. You know, and the reason I said receipt is because too many. Well, you know, the whole thing before you know, recognizing what the struggle and the connection between the community and the university, that the receipt was people were going to the universities to get, you know, I did the studies and I got my receipt. Now I'm going to continue the, you know, to be a part of the system that has already oppressed us. So the receipt thing is a takeoff from, you know, you go in there and you're buying something and they give you a receipt and go out and serve the world. You know, have a, so anyway, that's just that part of it. And as far as the university, the what do you call it? The High Potential Program. The High Potential Program was a program that came after I was already there during the time. Well, not too long before they began the High Potential Program. The High Potential Program drew people from the community, you know, that were not, you know, that maybe not had the academic skills, but had the qualifications. Yeah, they had that. So the campus during that time was had different organizations that were present, organizations that you know, were on there. And at the same time, San Francisco State, they had, you know, had the first Black Studies department, you know, in the country. And that also inspired a lot of the other people in the university to do it. At UCLA, we were into trying to establish a Black Studies department. Now, the conflict took place. Now, remember, we're talking about ideological differences, but the conflict took place over the selection of who would become the director of the newly minted Black Studies department. This was the basic entry. But what a lot of people don't know, that there also was a community advisory board. A community advisory board who would select who would be the director of the Black Studies Department.
And when you say conflict, you mean the conflict between the Panthers and us?
Yeah.
At UCLA.
At UCLA. It was an ideological difference in terms of who would be more beholden to the you know, who would, like, who the director would be more beholden to one organization or the other. This was like the perception if it wasn't the reality. So what happened was that the Community Advisory Board, which was Marlana Karinga was on it, they had Walt Breeman on it, they had somebody from SNCC. It was a collection of people, leaders in the community, and they would decide who would become the director of the Black Studies Department.
Okay.
So what happened was that Charles Thomas, his name, Charles Thomas was the one that they selected to do it. Now, you know, the students, you know, with, you know, with the Black Panthers supporting them, decided that they wanted to have a more democratic selection of who would be the director of the Black Studies Department. Now, it wouldn't have been violent until later on, because even this was, we were having the meetings on campus about, you know, well, maybe he shouldn't be, maybe, you know, and so it was this competition on campus about who, you know, who can get the students to rally around one, you know, of rejecting this selection by the community advisor, which was a, in my mind, looking at hindsight, you know, it was something worth looking at, because it was already set up that these leaders would select who would be the director of the Black Studies Union. So now you have this tension on campus about whether Charles Thomas should be appointed or whether he should not. In the end, he decided he didn't want it because it wasn't paying enough anyway. But right now, so now there's a room for, you know, the FBI. Now, I had some conversation with Geronimo, and we talked about, you know, this whole thing. And we found out that some of the same calls that he was receiving from some anonymous phone, you know, person, and at the same time, we were, my brother and I and the people in our organization, they were receiving the same calls. So, you know, we didn't know this at the time, but because of this conflict about who would be the director, and, you know, so what happened, there was a meeting. The first meeting took place January the 15th and on the UCLA campus, and Marlon Faria came there, and he was going to, you know, convince the students that, you know, we should accept the Charles Thomas. But half of the students said, no, we don't want this. They had another group talking, you know, that wanted it. So there was an agreement that we would set up another meeting on January the 17th. Now, January the 17th was supposed to be a meeting for us to come and try what the black students called it. They wanted to resolve the tension between the Panthers and us, as well as try to come up with some criteria for the Black Studies Department, and to make the announcement that Charles Thomas don't want the job because, you know, it's not enough. So he was out off the thing. So we had to get together and try to figure out how we're going to work this. Now, it's still no violence, but the tension is there because there was posturing in this room. You know, the Panthers, the us on one side, the Panthers on the other side. But for the most part, it was a fairly productive meeting, even though a lot wasn't accomplished, but we had things on the board. You know, you can see the picture with the criteria. People made selections. But what happened, there was a member of our organization, a young guy on our organization, who had an encounter with a Panther female.
Yeah, Elaine Lee. I mean, Elaine Brown. I'm sorry.
Yeah, you know, and I'm gonna tell you why. Well, I tell this story, but I tell this story not to play into COINTELPRO's narrative, because that's been going on for 50 years. And if I have time, I can tell you about, you know, how I like to tell this narrative. I don't want to go back into the you know, COINTEL has set up a framework for us to have a dialogue. And the framework is always conflictual. It's always we're going to have a point in blame, you know. And I realized a lot of this by talking with Erica and our conversations and what and who and the whole question of forgiveness and where the blame goes and how to look at the bigger picture and not try to get into these personal squabbles. But anyway, what happened was that these two people had a conflict. And a conflict was in Campbell Hall after the meeting. This person stormed out of the room and, you know, and complained that she was being, mishandled and so on. So what happened is that two people, and I can call them Bunchy Carter and John Huggins, came into the room to confront the person who so-called assaulted the female. What happened was because I was in the room as well. Now we got a picture of the room. The room has over 200 people in the room, so it's not like isolated in it. So you have a lot of people. People are leaving. Other people are having conversations about Che Guevara and what Eldridge spoke on the campus. So there's conversations on that, and so you had all this going on at the time. So get your mind out of it. It's not like a isolated incident and somebody came in and assassinated. Another thing. Okay, so what happened? They came in and they decided they wanted to pistol whoop the person sitting in the chair. In the event of pistol whooping, the gun went out. There's one shot that was fired that caused pandemonium in the whole room, where people started scattering. I'm jumping on the room and there was shots fired. I was hit in the shoulder, which is also played now. I was hit in the shoulder, and two Panthers were killed on the floor. And so that was that. That's setting the scene, and it's not theory. It's not, you know, I wasn't there, and it's not that I don't know exactly what happened at the time. The guns that Bunchy and John had was removed, and we have stories about that. And so the first initial thing that the DA was going to do after they said that it was the Steiner brothers and so on, they turned it into it was an assassination. Until they removed the bullet out of my shoulder and found out that it had. So they changed the whole thing. It was a conspiracy. They didn't get me for firing the shot. They didn't get my brother for firing the shot. You know, so eventually we were tried and convicted. Went through the whole death penalty thing. We had some unusual testimonies from people who testified and said they seen certain things. But no one could say that we fired a shot because I was out on bail on another charge, my brother and I. So in our organization, when you're on bail, because they were using it to drain our finances, and we call it economic assassination, where they put you out on bail on trumped up charges, and then you know then arrest you for something else, and your money, you know, is gone. So we always had someone that had security on us.
All right, but I got to ask you this because we're running out of time, and I really appreciate the depth of your explanation, all right? But, Brother Watani,
yes, sir.
The allegation has been made that, and in fact, Karenga has actually said that he was manipulated by the FBI and that he had a conscious alliance with them. Were you cognizant of this at the time of this incident?
The whole FBI theory thing, where we have to really, really look at that. Now, I don't think Kareem was an FBI agent. I don't think he was associated with the FBI. I mean, this is my understanding on that. Now, does he have, you know, personality flaws and stuff? I mean, we can freeze any of the leaders during the 60s at a certain
time. Watani, yes. In 1974, in the Black Scholar, yeah. Mr. Karenga did pen voluntarily an article. I think he might have been a professor at that time at UCLA, I think. And no, which school? Okay, all right, well, forget that part. Let me do my research and, you know, be right and correct. Yeah. But he certainly did. There's no question to this, because I did read the article, that he penned the article. And in the article, you know what, we're going to have to get back together and go over this in depth. Uh-huh. Because this is important enough to get it right.
It's very important.
Okay? But I believe, my recollection is, that he claimed that he had been manipulated by the FBI.
Yeah.
And you're saying that, to your knowledge, that there was no conscious relationship with the FBI between us, right, and the FBI. That this pretty much came out of competition between the Panthers and us that spun out of control.
I say that emphatically. I say that. Definitely that. As far as I think this is important for us to go back into and really look at how well the FBI has manipulated us, you know. And when I talk about COINTELPRO and the FBI and stuff like that, I do it. I try to do it anyway. Especially when I talk to young people, I try to talk not just about our strengths, but our weaknesses, because it was clear it would be impossible for the FBI to penetrate us if it wasn't some weakness in there. So we have to talk about those weaknesses as well. But somehow the narrative about, you know, conspiracy theories and stuff has stressed over time. And, you know, because, you know, I was in exile for 20 years. So I left the country, and I haven't walked the streets of this country, you know, in almost, you know, 48 years. So I've been out of the loop. So a lot of things that I've heard, I couldn't address because I was out of the country. But I think that that's an important part, not only for us to really to reconcile and get to truth and some kind of reconciliation that Eric and I think, well, I think Eric and I have really begun, and it's been very healing, it's been very beneficial for both of us, you know, and for the movement and for modeling for other people who are still going through these, you know, these demon things, and that, you know, that doesn't bring anything that, you know, that we can pass on to the next generation except this conspiracy theory that we keep carrying on. So I think that's very, very important for us to do.
Well, you know what? We are going to continue to delve into this deeper. And I want to thank you, brother, for stepping up and sharing this information. Let me just say, have you written down your recollections on this matter yet?
Yeah, I've been working on my memoir for quite some time.
Oh, you haven't released it, though?
No, I have to do the last chapter, and seeing like every time I get out, something else happens, and it keeps adding chapters. So I'm going to have to close it down some kind of way. But this conversation, you know, brings up a whole chapter, especially being out now.
Okay, now remember, we have a plane to catch here.
Oh, yeah.
And
yeah,
for that reason, and that reason alone, we're going to end this conversation and this interview right now. To be continued, okay, my brothers and sisters.
I want to thank you.
And I thank you for coming here at Slave Revolt Radio 104.1 on your FM dial at Berkeley Liberation Radio.
There's a new world coming, and it's just around the bend. There's a new world coming, this one's coming to an end. There's a new voice calling, and you can hear it if you try. And it's growing stronger with every day that passes by. Yeah, yeah, yeah. There's a brand new morning rising clear and sweet and free. There's a new day dawning that belongs to you and me. Yes, a new world's coming. You know the one I'm talking about, the one we've had visions of, and it's coming in peace, coming in joy, coming in peace, coming in joy, coming in peace, coming in joy, coming in love. And I saw another sign in heaven, great and marvelous, seven angels having the seven last plagues, for in them is filled up the wrath of God. And I saw as it were a sea of glass mingled with fire, and them that have gotten the victory over the beast, and over his image, and over his mark, and over the number of his name, stand on the sea of glass, having the harps of God. A new world coming, this one's coming to an end. There's a new voice calling, and you could hear it if you would just give it a try. it's growing strong with every day that passes by. And there's a brand new morning rising clear and sweet and free. There's a new day dawn that belongs.